First, let's try to make some points about the Shemen, kind of as the tail end of that very involved sugya, the first sugya of Hanukkah, which had many different topics come out of it. So Shemen is the last of them, and Shemen is connected to all of them, in a sense. So basically, just to highlight some points about it. So first of all, we assume lahalacha that we require a shear of Shemen, that we require a shear that should last a shtichle regel min hashuk, which the Rishonim have told us is basically a half hour. Maybe a little bit more, but basically a half hour. And it is possible that it's a machlokas in the Gemara whether or not there really is such a din, as we discussed in yesterday's Chazar, I think. We mentioned the point that the Gemara ends off with these two answers that might be one. And it says, what is the significance of the phrase Achatech L'Regel Min Hashuk? If it does not mean Kav Sozakuk La, if it does not mean you have to actively keep your candle burning, so what does it mean? So says the Gemara, either it means that's the zone in which you can light, or L'Shiura. That's the way most of the Rishonim read it, as opposed to the Rambam. So if that's true, it comes out that there's one din or the other here, either that you have to light within that zone, or there is a shear of Shemen. It seems like it's a suffix, which one? We mentioned yesterday that because it's a suffix, so each din kind of casts a doubt on the other, and that's why Tosfos said, for example, that even if the zone ends at Tichel Regel Min Hashuk, you might as well light afterwards because there is another opinion in the Gemara also. And it seems like the Rush paskins like both of these possibilities, the Chumra. The Rush paskins in the Siman Gimel that you can't go past the time, and in Siman Zayin he paskins that you have to have a shear of Shemen. So he paskins like both of these L'chumra. The Rav Yah quotes from Rabbeinu Tam, who paskins like both of these L'kula. And which we can understand from one perspective, because it seems to be a suffix to Rabbanan. And we mentioned a little bit the general question of, if you have a suffix to Rabbanan, so normally you're allowed to be makel, but what does it mean if it means being makel to the point where your kulas are mutually exclusive? So is that a problem, and would that apply here? So we discussed the fact that the Ran, Psachim, the last parak of Psachim, Adaf Kukhas, so the Gemara says that you need Haseba for the Dalet Kosos, but just for two of them. And we're not sure which one. It was two conflicting statements from the same author, that maybe just the first two, maybe just the last two. So the Ran over there has a discussion where he says, oh, so maybe you would think you could go Safek Lakula, and not to a Seba for any of them. Be made on the first two, be made on the last two, not to a Seba for any of them. So he says, no, that's not a valid approach. And one of the reasons he gives is that you can't say Safek to Rabbanan Lakula to negate a din. That we know there is a din of a Seba by the Dalet Kosos somewhere, and to say, okay, I'll be making on each one by itself because it's a Safek and I'll end up not doing this at all. So that's not a valid approach of, that's not a valid application of Safek Derabbanan Lakula. So is that the issue here, that since it's one statement or the other, if you're going to make it on both, you've totally left out this whole concept of Achitech L'Regel Min Hashuk? Maybe. Or should we say, no, it's not so much that there's an absolute din that we know applies somewhere, we just don't know how. It's two completely different dinim, we don't know which one it is, and therefore it's conceivable to be make it on both without, it's not like you're uprooting near Hanukkah by being make it on both of these shilas. So presumably, there is what to question about the application of Safek Derabbanan Lakula in this context, and maybe that's a little bit the issue. But in any event, the Shulchan Aruch seems to take a hard line on this, and Shulchan Aruch says that you have to have enough oil in the menorah to last, and if you don't, then you have to extinguish it and relight it with enough oil. So that has prompted the question, so does that mean you're relighting it with a bracha, because we really are sure the first one is nothing? So the pre-Chadash was of that opinion, you relight with the new bracha. But the others, the Mishnah Berurah, the Primigadim, and others assumed that maybe you shouldn't make a bracha the second time around, because again, it is a little bit of a suffix, this din may not exist, so therefore it's possible your first halakha was completely acceptable. So therefore you should maybe not make a bracha, because maybe you're not really mechuyev in the second, even if in practice, you're mechuyev, because we're concerned enough about that possibility, but maybe we're also choshish to the suffix, and therefore maybe don't make a bracha the second time. Hi.
Adding oil, maybe make a bracha on adding.
Right, so presumably not. I mean, it's an interesting question why the Lashon of Shulchan Aruch is to extinguish it and relight it. Why can't you just add oil? So the answer seems to be that we assume hadlaka osa mitzvah, in this case it's a lechumra application, means that just as we used it lekula, in a sense, to say kav salo zakagla, that if it goes out, you're not obligated to relight it because everything's in the hadlaka. So this is the lechumra side of it. Everything's in the hadlaka, so everything's got to be there when you light it. So if it requires a shear of oil, so if you lit it and there wasn't enough oil, so just putting in extra oil in is not going to accomplish what you need to accomplish. It has to be a hadlaka with that type of oil. And you could talk about that for a second about why that is. In general, it's an interesting question. So if we say that the shear of a half hour comes from Atratich L'Regel Menashuk, so what exactly does that accomplish when it's not during that time zone? If it means you're going to light during that time zone, we understand that, okay, you need to have enough oil to potentially cover the whole time zone. And the Rambam's opinion, who combines the two dinim, and to a certain extent the Shulchan Aruch copies this Lashon also, even though he has the extra din, but it seems to be that during the zone, so the idea is to light for whatever's left of the zone. So if that's less than a half hour because you started late, then that's less than a half hour. It's just to cover the rest of the time. So the idea of the shear of the oil being a half hour in that understanding is that there should be enough oil to cover all of the time of Atratich L'Regel Menashuk in actuality. But according to us, let's say if we light after that time, so then what do we gain by having a half hour's worth of oil? It doesn't mean anything. What's the significance of a half hour? So it's not an easy question to answer. And there are those who point to the Rashash on the Daf. I think it's the only Rashash on the Daf. In general, the Rashash is famous for having written on every Daf Rashash. This Amud maybe is the only Rashash, so it should be easy to find. It's a tremendous accomplishment. The Rashash was a wealthy businessman who found time to write on every Daf Rashash, which I don't know if any of the Rishonim did that. Rashi would have Rashi on every Daf Rashash. But we have the Rashash apparently in the Daf and Shas. So there's one Rashash on this Amud. So he's addressing a different question, but basically the Yisod that he says there is that there's an inyan of being madlik ba'ayin yafe, that you should light in a generous way, so to speak. You shouldn't be stingy when you light. So that therefore maybe this half hour shear, even if it's outside of the time when the half hour is relevant, but it reflects this idea of lighting generously. So we mentioned that this could have a nafkamina a little bit. Seems to be a question, what is the nature of the shear of oil? Is the shear of oil a functional shear? It's because you need the oil, you need the candle to actually last from point A to point B. Or is it not really functional? There's no significance per se to how long it lasts. But it's a chashivas, that it's not nice to light with less than this. It's not significant, it's stingy. And therefore you should have enough oil that your lighting is a significant lighting. And what difference does it make? We mentioned it may have a nafkamina for the halacha of ketute michtas shiure. That there is a halacha that if you use something that is supposed to be destroyed halachically, let's say hilchos sukkos, let's say hilchos lulav. You want to use a lulav shel asher. You want to use a lulav that's supposed to be destroyed, it's on death row, it's an idolatrous lulav. So the Gemara says that's not kosher for usage on Sukkos because of a principle of ketute mechta shiure, which means that if it's on death row, if it's supposed to be destroyed, so the Gemara says it's as if the shear is crumbled up, as if it doesn't have a shear. So it wouldn't matter if this lulav was 10 feet long, it's still considered to be halachically too small, it's not the right size, because it's waiting to be destroyed, it's on death row. So it's a question when that applies and when it doesn't apply. And there's a yesod that's famously associated with Reb Chaim Brisker and Hilchos Eruvin, but other Afronim say this idea as well. And they say that when do you apply this concept? There's different times in halacha when you have a shear. Sometimes you have a shear because it's about chashivas, that the item could work for the mitzvah. So you have a tiny little shofar, and maybe you can make it now with micro makings, that it's enough to be functional. It's not always an issue of functionality, but it's not chashuv, that's not going to be significant enough. So sometimes a shear is there just to lend something importance. So this halacha means that even if it's actually big, But if it's about to be destroyed, so it's not important for that reason, and it's insignificant because of its status of death row. So therefore, if the halacha of shir is about importance, so then that can't be applied when something has to be destroyed. That's as if it doesn't have a shir, regardless of how physically big it actually is. However, there are other times when you have a shir that is not there because of chashivas, it's there for practical purposes. You have a mitzvah that needs to reach a certain territory, needs to cover a certain amount of ground, because that's what's relevant. So then the shir is not a chashiva shir, it's a functional shir. So says Reb Chaim and many other achronim, in that halacha, in that context, you would not say kitute michtas shire, because as long as the item is physically big enough, then it has a shir, regardless of its future status. So you could ask the question, let's say you have oil that's supposed to be destroyed. Is that kosher for this purpose? Should we say ketute mechtas shire? Or should we say, no, it's good? So it depends, it would seem, on what kind of shir it is. But if it's a shir of chashivas, so oil that's supposed to be destroyed is not chashiv. But if it's a shir, it's just functional, you need to have a flame that's going to last for a half hour, so that we wouldn't care about the future status of this oil as long as it's here now to serve its purpose. So it happens to be, there is a Yerushalmi which says that you can use shemen sreifa if you have truma that became tameh. So it's supposed to be burnt. But Yerushalmi says you could use such oil for Hanukkah candles. And Achronim asked, well, how come that's possible? Why don't we say kitute mechta shire? Why don't we say if it's supposed to be destroyed, then it's as if it doesn't have a shir? So they say, well, maybe it's because the shir is functional here. It's not a shir of chashivas. It's a shir that has to just last a certain amount of time. So the truth is, that's the question. What type, how do you look at the shir? And we mentioned a little bit of a pilpul. This is just for your own enjoyment. That Kol Aryeh in his Chuvas, he thought that that's how you could explain that mysterious exchange in the top of the daf, where the Gemara says that they told the din of Kavsa Lozakukla in the name of Rav Yirmiyah, and Abaye didn't accept it. And then they said it again in the name of Rav, and he did accept it. So what was the difference? So says the Kol Aryeh, at first it wasn't about Rav Yirmiyah, it was that he couldn't accept that the halacha is Kavsa Lozakukla. How could it be that you're not obligated to relight a candle? It must be that you are obligated to keep the candle lit. Why? Because he knew that you're allowed to use Shemen Sreifa. You're allowed to use oil that's meant to be destroyed. So therefore, it must be that this oil, is the shear of the oil is functional, it's not chashivas. If it's functional, it means it's got to actually keep burning. How could it be that if it goes out, you're not obligated to relight it? So Rav, when he came in, said the same thing, so he accepted it from him, because Rav's opinion is that the obligation to burn Shemen Sreifa, Shemen Tuma, is only Midrabanan. So Min HaTorah, it doesn't have any decreased status. So then he said, okay, if that's the case, then maybe that's why we could use it, and it's not necessarily compelling to say that the oil has to actually last all this time. It's a very Pilpulish point. Feel free to not necessarily focus on that, just sharing that for your edification. And so far, so good. That was a little bit complicated. Okay, so in any event, so this is a question about the shear of the oil and how we relate to it. It comes out, it's a little bit paradoxical in a couple of ways. They point out that there's a conclusion that, according to the Rambam, is a little bit hard to believe, but it seems to be hard to refute. That, let's say, if somebody only has 15 minutes worth of oil, let's say right now it's Shkia, a half hour before Ashtech L'Ragol Menashah, and you only have 15 minutes worth of oil. So if you light now, you're not going to be yotze, because you don't have enough oil to cover the whole time. But if you wait, which the Rambam says normally not to do, and other Rishonim also say it's not right to wait, but if you choose to wait for 15 minutes, so then you will be yotze, because the 15 minutes you'll put in will cover the rest of the time. So it's a little bit hard to believe that that's the way it is, but it seems to work out that way, that you're better off waiting and having the oil cover the remaining time than lighting at the ideal time and having it go out in the middle, which is a little bit hard to understand. But it also reflects a basic paradox here, that in terms of covering the zman of Achatech L'Ragol Menashok, so we're clearly not makbid on that. We don't require the flame actually last that long. But terms of the potential, we're very machmir that when you light, it has to have potential to cover the whole time that's coming up. So it seems to be that this is the basic split we've been seeing the whole time. You're not really responsible for what happens after you light, but you are responsible for the original surah of the lighting, that it has to be kedasu kedin, that has to have all of its parts. And this relates to the whole kavsazakit blood discussion that we went over, that why is it that the whole focus is on that first minute? So it could be that that's just the whole responsibility you have in Neris Hanukkah. Or it could be that there's something inherent in this specific mitzvah that is contained in the first minute. It could be that this has to do with the nature of fire, as we discussed yesterday in the context of Hilchos Shabbos, that when it comes to fire, everything is credited to the first moment of lighting. So therefore, it's when you kindle that fire that whatever could theoretically happen afterwards is all included in that first minute. Or you could explain it a different way. There's another way to explain it, which I don't think I went into such detail the first time we said it, so I'll say it a little bit more slowly now, basically the first time. There is a concept in halacha called, we discussed this last year, we talked about the Shemaya Kohanah last year, right? So there is a concept in halacha called Kalaroi Labila, Ein Bila Ma'akadis. They're called She'einaroi Labila, Bilasal Ma'akadis, which means as follows, that let's say in halacha you have a lechatchila and a bidyavid, that if you do it this way, that's ideal, but if you don't do it this way, it's still good. So the halacha is often that, even if that's true, you don't have to do it the lechatchila way, but it has to be physically possible to do it the lechatchila way. If it's not physically possible, then the lack of possibility of doing it, that disqualifies your mitzvah. Not doing this detail does not disqualify the mitzvah. But if it's impossible, then it does disqualify the mitzvah. So the phrase, kol haroi lebila im bila ma'akaves, comes from the menachos. And that you have an obligation of a flower offering, of a mincha, and the Torah says it's got to be blula, it's got to be mixed up. That's one of the details. But if it's not blula, if it's not mixed up, so then you're still yotzei, it's still a valid mincha. Ein bilaso ma'akavis. But the halacha is, it has to be roi lebila. That it has to be possible. Let's say you have the mincha is packed in so tight that you could never mix up it anymore. It's all so compressed. So then that's no good. The bila is crucial in terms of it being possible. But in terms of it actually happening, that's less important. But it has to at least be possible. Kolaroi labila. If it's possible to mix it up, then ain't bilasa makavas. Einoroi labila. If it's not even possible, then that lack of possibility of bila, that messes it up. Everyone understand the principle? So there are those who understand what that means. Some of the Rishonim say that the reason we have this concern about roi labila is because if the Torah describes a mincha, and the Torah says the mincha should be mixed up. So, okay, it should be blula. Okay, so then maybe it's possible that detail is not crucial. It's possible that it doesn't have to actually be blula. But if I have a mincha where I can't even fulfill this requirement if I wanted to, then maybe there's something differing in the mincha that I have and the mincha the Torah is describing. Because the Torah is clearly describing a mincha where it's possible for it to be blula. Because it wants you to do that l'chatchila. So if you can't even have the possibility of doing it, maybe it means that there's a fundamental difference between this item and what the Torah is describing. Maybe there's something formally lacking in this item, regardless of the performance of the mitzvah that the Torah is talking about. So if you take that understanding here, you could say that kufs azakakla, etc., what does that mean? It means that the Torah, that the din of Hanukkah is that you have to light a candle. As long as you light a candle, so then whatever happens afterwards is not your problem. But a candle means it has to have the potential to last the time of the mitzvah. If it doesn't even have the potential, so then this is not the kind of candle Chazal we're talking about. Chazal we're talking about a candle that has the potential to cover the time of the mitzvah. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. But if it doesn't, he would have the possibility. So then that means this is not what the Chazal regard as a candle for this purpose, and there's something fundamentally lacking in your mitzvah, and maybe that's the way to look at it. Hi.
Do you mean
even it comes to Ein Zocher Gula, because we're saying, okay, you're not responsible to relight it, but because all we care about is potential. So in this way, it parallels the whole din of Ein Bilasa Makavis. We're saying, if you don't actually do this detail, then it's not your problem. But if it was impossible, if it never could have done this, then this is not what we're describing. The Torah, in the case of Mincha, and Chazal, in the case of the candle, we're describing something that ideally should accomplish this goal. So if it can't even possibly accomplish the goal, then it differs in a fundamental way from what the mitzvah is including. So if you have a candle which cannot even possibly last for a half hour, maybe this is not called a candle as far as this purpose. Maybe that you wouldn't even be considered having lit anything that is significant for Hilchos Hanukkah. So maybe it could be viewed that way. We also mentioned the question, so that paradox aside about waiting until we only have 15 minutes left, but let's say even now within our contemporary practice that we're not necessarily lighting in that zone, but let's say somebody only has 15 minutes worth of oil. That's all he has. He only has a small amount of oil. So is it kedai to light if that's all you have? So it opens up a couple of questions. First of all, you could say that it still might be kedai for you to try then to get it in the zone, because at least you'll have a view in Rishonim that that's enough. So to try to light 10 minutes before a half hour after Shkia. But separate from that, if this is all you have, so first of all, there is a view in Rishonim that you don't need a shear of oil, so it's certainly worth factoring in that opinion. And we also touched upon the fact that there is a general discussion about chatzi shear by mitzvos. That we know the Gemara tells us that there's a prohibition of chatzi shear by averos, which means, let's say, if you eat chazer, if you eat a kezias of chazer, so you're chayav malchus. But what if you eat less than a kezias? Let's say you have a little Hershey's Kiss made out of chazer. So in the Gemara, it comes out that that's prohibited too. It's not punishable, but it's prohibited. And it's a machlokas. Why? Machlokas in the Gemara, whether it's prohibited midrabanan or min ha-Torah. We paskin is prohibited min ha-Torah. And then in the Achronim, there's a machlokas what the issue is. There's the issue that it's basically a siag. It's a gezerah that we had the potato chips for, that we're afraid if you have one potato chip, you can't stop after one, and you'll keep going, you'll have the whole thing. So it's basically a safeguard. Maybe even min ha-Torah, as we've discussed in the past, there is such a thing. So maybe it's a din min ha-Torah that's a safeguard. Or no, maybe it's more fundamental than that. That if the Torah says, if you eat this much of this item, you'll be punished. So it's a way of conveying the message that this item is bad. If you have a tiny bit, it may not be actionable, it may not be significant, but it's still bad. Once it reaches a certain threshold, it's punished. It means the whole thing is bad. So even a little bit is bad. You shouldn't do it. You're not going to get punished for it, but it's an avera because the Torah is conveying that this is a bad substance. So those two possibilities could be relevant to answering a question that the later svarim brought up. What if you have a mitzvah? If you have a mitzvah and you don't have the whole shear, let's say you have only a half a kezias of matzah to eat Pesach night. So do you accomplish anything by eating a half a kezias of matzah Pesach night? So it probably depends. And in other words, is there a concept of chatzi shir by mitzvos? We know the Gemara says it's chatzi shir by averos. Does it apply by mitzvos too? So it probably depends on how you understand the isser. That if the issue of chatzi shir is that it's a safeguard, it's a gzera, so then that doesn't really come into play with mitzvos. We're not going to say a safeguard concept by a positive action. But if the logic is that if it's punishable at a certain level, it means the whole thing is bad, then that logic does flip. You could say that if it's rewarded at a certain level, it means it's good. That if matzah, you eat a kezias of matzah, you have a kind of a mitzvah, so matzah Pesach night is good. And you have a little bit, that's also good. And they also mentioned in this context that the language we always use might be significant. When we talk about a mitzvah, we talk about being yotzei a mitzvah, which we translate into English as saying, okay, you fulfilled the mitzvah. So it sounds like if you have less, if you're not fulfilling the mitzvah, what's the point? I didn't fulfill a mitzvah. But that's not really what the word means, right? The word yatsa yedei chovaso means to leave your obligation. So you say that, oh, if you had a, you had this much, you had a kezias or whatever, yatsa yedei chovaso, you have left your obligation. And anything less than that, you're still obligated. You still have to try to fill in more. But it doesn't necessarily mean that anything less than that is nothing. You could say it means that less than that is still significant. You just have not been yotze, in the sense you have not left the obligation until you have more. There's still obligation left. And once you reach a certain threshold, yatsa yedei chovaso. But less than that maybe is also significant. So that's just a general question the Sfarim have. So when it boils down to halach l'maisa, it certainly seems that if somebody only has an insufficient amount of oil, presumably should not make a bracha. Clearly should not make a bracha, it would seem. But it would also seem that it would be certainly advisable to light, either because of a general attitude of chatzi shir by mitzvos. And here also, in addition to that, there's also a view in the Gemara, maybe, that there is no requirement of a shir, so you might want to hang on to that possibility anyway. So it certainly seems like it's very advisable. Anybody who doesn't have enough oil certainly should light whatever he has, and not make a bracha. So I think that was most of what we said about the issues of shemen and shir. Any questions about any of that? Any issues? Okay, so now let's move on to hither. Yeah.
Sorry, didn't we talk about the purposely extinguishing?
Purposely, we talked about that in Kav Sezakakla, we talked about that. Okay. Yeah, so I think that was, it's relevant to the whole thing, right, that the truth is it's more based on this halacha than it is based on that, but we talked about it in that context. That Rav Shlomo Zalman, who had the tshuva, saying that you're not yotze if you don't, if you plan on extinguishing it, and you do, is because it's comparable to not having enough oil. It's an extension, though. So that basically, this idea is extended to three points. We know from the Rishonim and the Gemara that lahalacha, at least, if you don't have enough oil, that's not enough potential, and therefore it doesn't last. Then Poskim extended that to say that if there's something else that will stop it from lasting, that's also like there's no oil, even though not all the Poskim accepted this. But let's say, for example, to say that if it's a windy place outside, so that also is going to interfere with it lasting, you could have a ton of oil, but the wind is going to extinguish it, that's comparable to it not having enough oil, which is a chiddush, but many poskim accepted this chiddush on top of this din. And then Rav Shlomo Zalman went further and said, not only if there isn't enough oil, and not only if there's something physical that will put it out, but if there's only your intent to put it out, that's also comparable, even though left to itself, there's no physical reality that will make this, that will necessarily make this flame go out. Your intent is also considered to be like a lack of potential, and anything that means that this candle never had a shot in the world, that's all going to be relevant. Okay, so any other questions about Shemen issues, or really anything from that first passage? So we now basically have looked at all four of those sugyas. Again, it's Kav Sezakuk La, Isla Shamish La Orev, Zman of the Hadlaka, and the oil. And they all come together. They're not just four things that are randomly put there, but they all reflect the fact that, again, that one is basically chai, basically accomplishing something with the first second of lighting. But in addition to that, there is a value to keeping it lit as long as possible that we see from also the fact that those who say Yisla Shtamish La'ura, even after the time has passed, reflect the fact that there's a mitzvah going on, even and even certainly after the first second, so there's certainly a mitzvah going on as long as it lasts, and even past the half hour probably is also such a mitzvah. And just, I don't know if I mentioned during the Chazara, but just also one important Mar Makom was the Rush in the Rebbe Kiv Eger. I don't remember if I had hazarded this, but the Rush in Pesachim, in the first parak of Pesachim, the Rush says that the whole discussion of Rishonim have different theories there as to when you make a bracha with a language of Al, and when you make a bracha with a language of Le. So here the Rush says that you make a bracha of Lahadlik Ner Shel Chanukah. It's part of a whole theory there that he has. You make that use that language when the mitzvah goes on for some period of time. So the Karban Asano and others ask, what are you talking about? Kav Selo Zakak La, it doesn't go out, it doesn't go on. If you only have to, it only has to last for 1 second. What do you mean that it goes on for some period of time? So some say, well, he's talking about the other din. He's talking about that you have time to do it. But others explained that no, what he means is that even though if it went out after 1 second, you wouldn't be obligated to relight it, but still, as long as it lasts, you're fulfilling your mitzvah. So therefore, the mitzvah does go on, even though you could theoretically be off the hook if it ended earlier. Okay, so again, those are some of the major points in the thematic connection between all of those sugyas that introduced the whole Hanukkah passage in our Gemara. Hi.
Doesn't the discussion of all of that it's not necessarily limited to just the distinction between the action being done then and it being continuous, but also whether or not you individually are supposed to do it versus someone else?
Right. Other Rishonim, the Ran, there are other Rishonim invoke that distinction. There are other theories in the Rishonim as to what is it that makes it be al or le, and that's also one of them.
Does that ever become relevant to this discussion? Or
yeah, it actually does come up. We'll get into a little bit of the Chovas Abayis, so I have to do that also.
Right.
All right, so we'll probably get to that tomorrow, hopefully. All right, so we still have a lot more to come. Yeah, but that's us. Anyway, so this rush is way back when Rabbi Kiva Eger is, it discusses this in the Tshuva, which is also relevant to the Hiddur Sugya, same Tshuva, that it sounds like from this rush that the point is that the mitzvah is continuing. Okay, so we spoke about hiddur both in the general sense and in the Hanukkah sense. We spent the day talking about the concept of hiddur b'chol Torah kula, and then we approached the sugya of hiddur in Hanukkah. So just to quickly go over the hiddur b'chol Torah kula issue. So first of all, the din of hiddur mitzvah as a general Torah value is connected to the pasuk in Parshas B'shalach, where we say it by Kriyas Yamsuf. In Az Yashir, they say, Zeh Keli V'Yanvehu, this is my God, V'Yanvehu. So what does the word V'Yanvehu mean? The Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Kuf Lamed Gimel, has a couple of possibilities. One of them is that it comes from the word Noveh, beautiful, that I will beautify God. So it says the Gemara, how do you beautify God? That doesn't seem to make sense. So you beautify God by doing mitzvos in a beautiful way, by using beautiful mitzvah items. And the Gemara lists off a few cases how you would do that. So, is this really a din min haTorah, the pashup shot of the pasuk, or is it a din drabanan? So that seems to be a machlokas. Many Rishonim did assume that it was a drabanan. A few did assume it was daraisa. And they bring various proofs that it might be one or the other. We focused on two of them. One is the chiddush of the Ritva on Daf Yud Aleph and Sukkah. The Ritva has a principle there, which not everyone agreed with, but other Rishonim had as well. Relates to what we just spoke about a few minutes ago, about Lechachila and Bidyeved. And the Ritva maintains that in general, you have a Torah law, it's not really Lechachila Bidyeved. That the concept of Lechachila and Bidyeved, that's really by rabbinic laws. So, in that context, he says that the Hiddur Mitzvah has to be Drabana. Because if it was min haTorah, it would have to be ma'akev. It would have to be crucial. The fact that it's optional, so to speak, that means it must be a din d'rabbanan. And then we also discussed that there is a machlokas in the Gemara and a machlokas in the Rishonim. That the Gemara says in Bava Kamma and Daf Tes that if you want to figure out what's the reasonable expenditure, a reasonable outlay for a hiddur mitzvah, so the Gemara says, ad shlish, you add on a third. So what does that mean? Let's just take Rashi's formulation. It means that let's say you have a kosher esrog that you could buy for a certain amount of money, and then there is a better esrog you could buy. So if the better esrog is a third more, it's worth going for it. If it's 10 times as much, that's not your responsibility. So then the Gemara says, what does the third mean? Mathematically, how do you calculate a third? Is it milavar or milagav? Is it from the outside or from the inside? In other words, should it be 33%, like we would normally assume talking about a third? Or should we say that no, it's actually 50%? Why would it be 50%? How is that a third? Because if you add on 50% to something, now it's a third of the new total. So if you had $10 and you add on 5, it's 50%. But now 5 is a third of the new total of 15%. So how do we calculate it? So that's a machlokas in the Gemara, and the Gemara doesn't answer the question, leaves it open. So a lot of the poskim write that we take the more lenient number, the 33%. So if that's the case, so some assumed, why would you say that? Because it's a safek and a din d'rabbanan, and they're mako. In other words, the assumption being that hiddur mitzvah is a din d'rabbanan. And there were others who were machmir. Maybe they felt differently. Maybe they felt it was a din mehatar. So in any event, this is a big machlokus about hidden mitzvah. Is it a din derabanan or a din deraisa? And there are opinions on both sides. And many assume that it is a derabanan. And then that prompts the question that the Dvar Yeshua talked about. That what does the pasuk mean then? So if the pasuk does not mean hidden mitzvah, so what does it mean? We mentioned that the Chassam Sofer in his Chiddushim to Gittin writes that it does mean at least Zach Kehli, God, that does have to be beautiful. In other words, if you're writing a Sefer Torah and you're writing the Shem Hashem, that has to be Mehudr. But anything else about Hidr Mitzvah, that's a Din Derabanan. But there is a application of Hidr Mitzvah Daraisa for the Pasuk to be referring to. But the general idea that other mitzvahs should be beautiful, that's a Din Derabanan. So we pose the following question to try to understand the whole concept. What exactly do we mean when we say that hidr mitzvah is a desired action? Do we mean to say that it's worthwhile because it expresses our enthusiasm and our commitment to the mitzvah? That we're willing to do the mitzvah not just in a minimal way, that would be yotze yidei chavasan, but we want to show that we're excited about it, that we're happy to do it, so therefore we will go the extra mile. So there are a number of halachos which might be based on such logic. Right? For example, this might also be the reason, each one is a separate discussion. We could give a whole share on each topic, but each one, this may be the reason. We have a concept of zrizin makdimin l'mitzvos, we do mitzvos at the earliest possible opportunity. We have a concept of mitzvah bo yoser mibishlucho, that we would prefer, even when a mitzvah could be done through a shliach, we would recommend that you do it yourself. So all of these principles might mean that in situations where a mitzvah could be fulfilled in a certain way, it's still better for you to do it in a way that shows more personal involvement, excitement, enthusiasm. So better do it yourself, quickly, and to go all out. That's what a hidr mitzvah is, maybe. Or alternatively, you could say that really it's a whole different idea, and that has to do with visual impact. That there is a notion which all the major world religions have seem to agree upon, that for the physical items that are associated with mitzvos to be, or they're associated with whatever the religion is, that it should be glorious and aesthetically impressive, is an ideal that we find in many cultures, and including halacha, the idea that the shul should be the highest building in the city, et cetera, all the ideas that if you have something that's overtly associated with a religion, so we want that it should impress people, and that's considered to be something that indirectly brings glory to God. We can't see God, we can't beautify Him directly, but we can beautify the mitzvos that are connected with Him, and that's a way of impressing people with the glory of God. So if that's the case, so then that might be what hidden mitzvah is about, that it's just a recognition that whenever there is a mitzvah, if it can be visually impressive, so then that's something to take pride in. So we then try to see how could that apply to the sugya. First of all, in terms of the Ritva's point, that hidden mitzvah should be ma'akev, hidden ma'atarah, so we said, well, maybe it depends. Maybe even if you accept his chiddush, that all the halachos in the Torah have to be ma'akev, that could mean that the details of a specific mitzvah have to be ma'akev. But maybe hidr mitzvah is not about this mitzvah. It's about how you relate to mitzvahs as a whole. It's a halacha in you. So the halachos of this mitzvah, all of them are ma'akev. But the halacha of hidr mitzvah is not about any individual mitzvah. It's about you specifically. It's a separate question, and therefore it's possible you could be lacking that, but the mitzvah might still be satisfied. So maybe you don't, even if you agree with the Ritva's opening premise, you don't necessarily have to see it as conclusive on this point. Parenthetically, we didn't get into this too much, but we should note that it's possible that Lulav and Esrog have a different din, and there's a discussion about this in Machlokas Rashi and Tosfos and Daf Chavtes in Sukkah, about whether the fact that the Torah says, in describing an Esrog, pre-ates Hadar, that maybe the requirement of Hidr is more fundamental to an Esrog than it is to other mitzvahs in the Torah, and maybe it doesn't necessarily follow the same standard, that's a possibility as well. Okay, so we also went back to the point about the shlish, about the spending a third, and we noted that that interpretation, that it's about how much you spend to get the more expensive hiddur mitzvah, that's Rashi's interpretation. But Tosfos has a different way of reading the Gemara. Tosfos says that, let's say you have an opportunity to buy an esrog that's kosher, and there's another esrog that's one-third bigger. So then you should go for that esrog. But you don't have to go for an esrog that's 10 times as big. So the difference between Rashi and Tosfos is that Rashi is about how much you are spending on the mitzvah, how much it's taking out of you, so to speak, while Tosfos is about the impact, and perhaps that's the machlokus as to what hiddur mitzvah is meant to accomplish, that a bigger mitzvah item is going to have a bigger impact regardless of how much you ended up spending on. And then we discussed this could be relevant to another issue. All of these issues we saw ended up being reference points when we got into Hanukkah, but it's all relevant to the general issue as well. What if you have a hiddur that's not visible? So let's say, for example, when it comes to a Sefer Torah, so we have a Kepeda, Sefer Torah has to be written in a beautiful way, and it has to be written with a sirtut, with underlines in the Torah, so that the lines are going to be very straight. That's all a requirement of of hiddur mitzvah. But when it comes to the parshiyos of tefillin, so there is a machlokas within the Rishonim, does that apply as well? That you have parshiyos of tefillin, is there also such a requirement? So what's the difference? The difference is that no one sees the parshiyos of tefillin there, except for the sofer and whoever would check it later. It's all wrapped up and put inside a sealed box. So it's only the Sefer Torah that's visible, so maybe it's only there that you have hiddur mitzvah. So it's maybe the same question. But is hiddur mitzvah about the effort that you put into it? It's really between you and God, it doesn't matter, but no one else is going to see it? Or is it about impressing people with a visual presentation, in which case if it's not visible, then it's not really worthwhile? This could also be relevant to another fundamental machlokas, which is also going to be invoked in the context of Hanukkah. The following issue that the Gemara says in the Sugya of Hiddur Mitzvah and Shabbos and Daf Kuf Lamed Gimel, so the Gemara says a person is doing a bris milah, so there is a minimal way to do it. It's called the tzitzin hama'akfin asanilah, the parts that are crucial to the mitzvah. And then there is a hiddur mitzvah, which the Gemara calls the tzitzin she'ena ma'akfin asanilah. Does not hold back the fulfillment of milah, but it's still recommended, still a hiddur. So Gemara says that if you're in the middle of the cut and you haven't finished yet, so then you should try to do it perfectly. Cut also the tzitzin she'ena ma'akfin, also get the hiddur mitzvah. But if you've already lifted your hand up, you've already finished the cut, then you have to go back if there was something that was ma'akid, if there was something that was crucial that you didn't cut. But if it's not ma'akid, if it's just a hiddur mitzvah, you don't go back. So why should you go back to the hiddur mitzvah? So most of the Rishonim understand, Rashi and Tosfos and the Rabban and the Rama, they all understand that what we're talking about is that it's Shabbos. Right? That's where the Gemara appears in Maseches Shabbos, that since it's a chiddush that you could do a bris milah on Shabbos to begin with, so we would not let you go back and make a new cut for something that is not crucial to the mitzvah. However, the Rambam is the exception. The Rambam in Hilchos Milah in Perek Beis Halacha Daled, the Rambam writes that this is the din during the week as well, that you don't go back and start a new cut after you've already finished cutting, if the only need is that of a hiddur. So what's the machlokus about? So many achronim, this discussion about this in the Shagas Aryeh, in the Beis Halevi, and others have all kinds of different versions of this. But many suggest that the machlokus is that according to the Rambam, let's say, you can't have a hiddur mitzvah disconnected from the mitzvah itself. The mitzvah and the hiddur have to be joined. So if you've already finished doing the mitzvah, it doesn't make sense to go back and do a hiddur. While the other Rishonim were saying, apparently that you can come back and do a heder separate from the mitzvah. So therefore, it's only Shabbos that you don't do that because of the malacha, but during the week you would. So we discussed how not everyone accepted that type of distinction. It's a little bit hard because it's hard to believe that the Rambam's opinion is not unanimous. Would anyone really think that you could have a heder mitzvah separate from a mitzvah? Think, okay, here's my kosher esrog, and here's my beautiful esrog. All right, now I'm being yotzei the mitzvah of esrog. Now I'm being yotzei the heder of esrog. Would anyone really think that works? Presumably not. It's hard to imagine that's called a heder. A heder has to be on the mitzvah, with the mitzvah. So does anyone really disagree with that? I mentioned parenthetically the whole brain teaser about if you have two esrogim to pick up, one's definitely kosher but not necessarily mahoder, you're not sure, and the other one is definitely mahoder but might not be kosher. Which one should you pick up first? And the intuitive answer is kashrus is more important than heder, so pick up the kosher one first. But the Reb Chaim and the Beis Halevi and the Shuvas, they all said that no, do it the other way around, because if you pick up the definitely kosher one first, you're finished. So if it's mahoder, great. If not, you're done and it's just kosher. But if you pick up the other one first, which is definitely mahoder, so if it's kosher, good, then it's kosher and mahoder. And if not, then you'll pick up the other one. But it all works off the premise that they really have to come together. You can't have a heder separate from the mitzvah. So probably everyone agrees to that. And some formulated a little differently, that everyone agrees you can't have a mitzvah completely disconnected from a heder. The question is, a heder completely disconnected from mitzvah. But the question is, what do we mean by connected and disconnected? So if you have a mitzvah that's ongoing, like bris milah, because the Rishonim explain that it's not just the action of the milah that's a mitzvah, but it's the status of having a bris milah that is also a mitzvah. So therefore the mitzvah goes on. So maybe you could add on because the mitzvah is continuing. But the Rambam's position is that the maisa has to be together. The action of the mitzvah has to be together with the heder. And if you don't have that, then even if the mitzvah is in continuing fulfillment, you can't go back and fix that. So then it could be that really maybe the Rambam's view here is that heder is really all about a mitzvah. It's all about a maisa mitzvah. Heder is all about how you do the mitzvah. Do you do the mitzvah with enthusiasm? While others might say it's more about the end impact. If you have a picture that's impressive, we don't really care if you all did it all in one action because it's all about impact. But the Rambam's view is it's all about what the mitzvah means to you in terms of how you do it, and therefore it's significant that it should have it should all happen as you're doing it. And there are those who point out that if you look through the Rambam Mishnah Torah, he doesn't seem to record at all the halacha of beautiful mitzvah items. He seems to only have a notion of heder mitzvah in terms of how you do things, and that maybe is his shita. And then we mentioned a few other examples from Rishonim where they invoke the term heder mitzvah in terms of an action, how you're doing an action, and not when there's an object to look at. So for example, the first Mishnah in Pesachim, from the first Mishnah, the 10th Parak of Pesachim, Adav Tzadi Tassim Pesachim, so the Mishnah says one should not eat too much on Erev Pesach. And Rashi and the Rashbam over there say, because it's a hiddur mitzvah to eat the matzah bitte avon. You should have a good appetite, and that'll be a hiddur mitzvah. So that's not about how it looks. Presumably how it looks will be a little bit less mahoder. But the idea that you should do the mitzvah with enthusiasm, that's apparently called a hiddur in that context. And there's also a view of Tosfos and Brachas and Daf Vav Aleph. That Tosfos says that if you have a bracha that you could listen to from someone else, it's still better to do it yourself. And that also, he calls that a hiddur mitzvah as well. So that seems to also be a notion that doing things in a more involved way is called hiddur, according to the Rambam, and maybe some other Rishonim, and not necessarily about how it works and what's going to be the visual impact. So then we mentioned that the Achronim in general have a lot of questions about hiddur mitzvah. To what extent is a hiddur mitzvah grafted onto a mitzvah and becomes a part of the mitzvah itself, or is it just something that's separate? And we suggested it could depend on this overall question. And one of the nafkaminas everyone seems to agree is not there, that you're not going to be mechal Shabbos for a hiddur. That's what we just saw about the Gemara about the bris milah, that you're not going to go back and make a new cut, even according to the other Rishonim, just for the purposes of a hinder. So the problem is, as mentioned, there is a Gemara in Menachos, which calls that into question a little bit. The Gemara says in Menachos that if you have a korban sibur, so you have a sacrifice that needs to be brought on behalf of the entire geula, so then that's one of the conditions for something to be dofe Shabbos. It could theoretically be prepared on Shabbos. So you could shecht an animal for the purposes of a korban sibur on Shabbos. But what if you really have an animal already, but you see a better one? So you've already shechted an animal that is somewhat of a shach animal, but it could work. And now you see a fatter animal, an animal that would be a better korban. So what should you do then? So the Gemara says you should shecht that even on Shabbos. So apparently you're shechting on Shabbos, you're being dofe Shabbos for something which seems to be a hinder mitzvah. Because the mitzvah itself you have a less impressive animal, and it's just for the goal of having a more impressive animal that you're going to be mechal Shabbos. So many explain, you mentioned Rabbi Warman, Zichron Lebracha, as having commented in this way, that this is not about Zekei Levi and Vei. This is a whole different din, that there is a separate requirement when it comes to Kodshim of Mimivchar Nidracha, that you should use the best of what you have for korbanos, and maybe that's more ma'akev, that's a bigger deal, that's not the normal hiddur mitzvah of Zekei Levi and Vei. Okay, I think that was the basic general introduction that we gave to hiddur mitzvah. Any question about any of that? Any issues? Okay, so let's, for the next few minutes, try to get into the topic of Mahadrin by Chanukah. So basically, we know that the Gemara says that the whole notion we have today of a menorah, which is so well known, and so everywhere, is not actually a requirement on Chanukah. That mitzvahs Chanukah ner yishu beiso, that all Chanukah really requires is one candle per household, per person, per night of Chanukah. So if you have one, if you have, let's say, five people in the house, and it's the seventh night of Chanukah, still all you need is one candle. That's the whole din. Then the Gemara says, you want to be Mahadran, you want to do better, so then you should have a candle per person. And if you want to be super duper extra religious, so then that's Mahadran, Min HaMahadran, the best of the best. And then that's where the menorah comes in. That's when you either go up according to Beis Hillel, you go down according to Beis Shammai. And the Gemara gives two reasons for the difference between the two. One reason is we want to count the days that have been or the days that have yet to come, so either going up or going down. Or the other reason is that we go up in order to evoke the theme of Malam B'Kodesh V'Ein Marizim, that in matters of Kedusha we go up. It's pointed out that, first of all, this is an unusual application. Normally that means that you have an item that's used for something holy, so you don't then use it for something less holy. You only use it for more holy things. But not that when dealing with matters of Kedusha, you only use higher numbers. That's an unusual application. And in addition to the fact that it's not clear that there is Kedusha here, but whatever it is, the whole application is unusual. And Beis Shammai is also unusual. And Beis Shammai says that Keneged Parei HaChag, that we want to evoke the Korbanos on Sukkot, which went down, so therefore we go down here as well. And we got into a little bit about the lumpness of the different Beis Hillel Beis Shammai explanations and about their positions. We mentioned some Papulish explanations of the issue. Maybe we won't necessarily go into that right now in the interest of time. But in any event, so Beis Hillel's view is that we go up, and that's what we all do, except that some pointed out, Rava pointed out, this may still be an open question, because the Gemara afterwards tells a story about two Zakenim who lit Chanukah candles. One did like Beis Hillel, one did like Beis Shammai, and they explained their reasonings based on the Malam B'Kodesh Yom HaRidim versus Parei HaChag Svaras. And the Rava understands that the point of that story is to tell you that it's still an open issue, that you still have the right to follow Beis Shammai if you want to. But nobody nowadays does that. We all follow Beis Hillel. But even within this, there is a machlokas as to how these opinions are performed, practically speaking. That Tosfos quotes from the Ri that if you have a you want to go for the third level, you want to go per person, the Hadron and the Hadron. So that means you skip the second, so you want to go per night, so you want to go per night, the Mahadran and the Mahadran, then you skip the per-person basic Mahadran package, right? The I guess you call it the silver package, and you have the basic package, the silver package, and the gold deluxe. So if you're going to go for the silver package, that's one thing, or if you go for the gold package, that's one thing, but you don't combine the two. Why should you not combine the two? Because, says Tosfos, if you're going to do that, you're not going to have any kind of a coherent message. It's the third night of Hanukkah, and you have four people in your house, you light 12 candles, no one's going to know what 12 candles means. It has all kinds of mathematical possibilities. So if you're trying to send a message of how many nights of Hanukkah, you're not going to accomplish anything by mixing the system. And the Rambam disagrees. The Rambam says exactly what Tosfos doesn't like, that that's how you do it, that Balabayas lights candles per person, and then per night for Mahadran and Mahadran, which means it does both. So the Rambam says if it's 10 people in the house, and it's the 8th night of Hanukkah, so you light 80 candles, even though 80 candles is not something that can be perceived as knowing what the numerical significance is. Doesn't seem to be worried about that. And Lahalacha, we find an unusual split, that the Shulchan Aruch generally follows the Sfaradim, in this case follows Tosfos, and the Ramah, who generally follows the Ashkenazim, in this case, seems to follow the Rambam. That the Rambam's position of having 80 candles on that scenario, the Rambam says you do that also. But there is a big deviation from the Rambam's position, which is probably very significant, that the Rambam says every person in the household lights their own menorah. While the Rambam never said that. The Rambam said the Baal Bayis lights all the candles that are being put out there. So that's a pretty significant deviation. And there are those who explain, like Rav Shlomo Lumi Vilna, that the Ramah is not really fully endorsing the Rambam. The Ramah is really combining the two views. On the one hand, he gets the Rambam's final count of 80 candles, but he's also worried about Tosfos's hecker issue, that it should be recognizable. So therefore, the Ramah has a suggestion, if everybody lights their own menorah, so that will create distinct units. So if you have four people in the household, third night of Hanukkah, you won't just have 12 candles, which won't mean anything. You'll have four menorahs, that each one will have three of their candles in. That perhaps will be more recognizable, so maybe it's really the Rambam plus Tosfos. Hi.
The hecker there is for people in the household?
So in this case, it could be hecker people outside also, that if they see menorahs in the door, menorahs in the window, and the menorahs are set up like that, it look like separate people doing the lighting, and each one with its own recognizable number. So that could be the difference between the Rambam and the Ramah. The Brisker Rav had a famously Lumdish explanation, where now, because the Chazar, we say both on the same day, it keeps it easy to remember. So he said that it was totally on what we just said a few minutes ago about Bris Milah on the Hiddur Mitzvah of Bris Milah. That if you recall from a few minutes ago, so the Rambam's view was you don't go back and finish the Bris Milah, the Hiddur. And the other Rishonim say you do, it's only on Shabbos that you don't. And we mentioned the explanation that Hiddur Mitzvah has to be connected to the Mitzvah itself, according to the other Rishonim, according to the Rambam, rather. And the other Rishonim seem to say that you can have a Hiddur Mitzvah disconnected from a Mitzvah. So he thought that was the same issue here, L'shitasa, that since the extra candles are a Hiddur Mitzvah, so therefore, according to the Rambam, the Baal Bayis has to light all the candles, because Hiddur Mitzvah has to be done with the Mitzvah itself. And according to the Ramah, you could have a Hiddur separate from the Mitzvah, so therefore you could also have people lighting their own candles that are only the Mahadran, they can be separate from the Mitzvah itself. So that's the way the Brisker Rav explained the Machlokas. And others didn't like this for a number of reasons, but one of the major issues is he seems to be assuming that there's a parallelism to be drawn between the Hiddur Mitzvah that we spoke about a few minutes ago, the Hiddur Mitzvah of Kol Torah Kula, and the Hiddur Mitzvah of Hanukkah. And maybe it's not true. Maybe the Mahadran of Hanukkah is a special Mahadran. Maybe it's not connected to Zeke Levi on Dehu. So this is a issue that a lot of Achronim took up. What exactly is the story? When we say Mahadrin, Mahadrin, Min Mahadrin, so is this an expression of Zekeli V'Anveyu that we spoke about a few minutes ago? Or is this a special din by Hanukkah that's not connected to any other Hidurim in the Torah? It's its own concept of Mahadrin. So there are a couple of indications that that's the case, that it's a special concept. First of all, the whole language is so different. The Mahadrin, Mahadrin, Minha Mahadrin. We joke that if you see a restaurant in Israel that has it in Sashgacha, it's Mahadrin, Minha Mahadrin. It means that they light 8 candles on the 8th night of Hanukkah, because that's a unique term here. So that whole phrasing with having extra levels, that already kind of sets it apart from a standard Heder Mitzvah, which said also the requirement of Shlish, that you only add on a third, that's completely blown out of the water when it comes to Hanukkah. Any Mahadrin you're going to do, from the most basic level to the simplest Mahadrin, it's going to cost you at least twice as much money, if not many, many times that much money. So how do you have this limited Shlish in this context? So there are some indications that this is a unique type of Hider. And we mentioned that there are some who want to suggest that that's the Machlokas, the Rambam and Tosfos. So we mentioned the Rav Zsolti in the Mishnas Yavetz. He writes that he thinks that Tosfos sees this as a standard Hider Mitzvah, and that's why Tosfos is concerned about Heker, that it should be recognizable, because that's a rule by Hider Mitzvah in general, and it should be perceptible. While the Rambam is not worried about Heker, because the Rambam thinks that this is not a standard Hider Mitzvah, but that is a unique concept that by Hanukkah becomes built into the fabric of the mitzvah itself, and we're not so worried about whether it could be perceived by others or not. And he brought a proof that the halacha of that you go begging in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Neres Hanukkah, which is found in the Rambam and in the Shulchan Aruch, but the Shulchan Aruch might mean, the way he's interpreted by later sources, that if you go begging for Neres Hanukkah, it's only for one candle, because that's the Iker Mitzvah. You can't expect somebody to go begging for a Hider Mitzvah. But the Rambam, the way he's interpreted, may say differently, and the Rambam might maintain that even for a Hider Mitzvah, even for the extra candles on Hanukkah, you should go begging. So that's a striking position. And the Rav Zsolti says, oh, you see, the Rambam says that because he believes that the Mahadrin of Hanukkah is more fundamental and it's built into the mitzvah itself. So we wanted to suggest really the opposite. We wanted to suggest that yes, there is such a machlokas here about whether this is a standard hider or whether it's a special hider. But we also acknowledge that there are these proofs that we mentioned a minute ago that it really does seem like a special hider. So we suggested the question you could ask is this a completely unusual hider that's got nothing to do with any other mitzvah in the Torah? Or should we say that in its format, it's really a standard hider mitzvah? But the difference is, in terms of commitment, you have to spend more money, you have to go begging, you have to go to greater lengths to do it, but it's not necessarily a fundamentally different type of mitzvah. So, a different type of Hider Mitzvah. So we suggested in that spirit that really the Rambam is the one who's talking about something more traditional. He's talking about a more basic Hider Mitzvah, because he's talking about a larger presentation, a larger plane. That's the Hider according to him. While Tosfos is saying you have to be able to read the message, we're concerned that you can read the words, that's something that is unique to Hanukkah, and therefore that's a Mahadrin that's of its own class. So what emerges here is that there is a machlokas between Rashi and Tosfos and the Rambam about whether we're concerned with Heker or not. Is that absolutely crucial? And perhaps there's also a machlokas here about whether the Hider of Hanukkah is unique in terms of how Hidurim are played out, and it is built into the mitzvah itself. So we have to do tomorrow. Tomorrow we want to chazar as much as we can, but at least we want to finish our Hanukkah chazar. So in order to do that, we have to finish this topic by basically talking about how this difference between whether or not we care about Heker so much how that plays out in practical terms, and also the question of whether the other neiros of the Mahadran, are they treated with the same type of status as the Ikar Mitzvah? That affects halacha, and we have to talk about Chovas Avayis and about Shamish. That was the most recent sugya, so less, maybe at least the meeting of Chazar, we should try to get that. So at least the Hanukkah sugya, we should try to get Chazar. Again, anybody needs any supplemental assistance on the point, I'm always available, but also remember that Ephraim is our Chazar man. He's happy to set up Chazara sessions and the like, and to share his notes if anybody didn't get them. So please be in touch with Ephraim about that. And in terms of, again, of the signing up sheet for the Bechina, please be in touch with Jonathan. All right, so we have Rosh Chodesh Davening, who's...